Today we will be in John chapter 2, and we'll be picking up in verse 14, right after, verse 13, in fact. I've got the wrong thing on the slide, but picking up in verse 13, just after where we left off last week. But before we go any further, I want to introduce you to some people. This is the Markham family. They are a family down in Utah. You probably won't know of them. But what we have here, Dad, Dan, Mum, Leslie, as well as their three kids, son Lincoln on the end there, as well as their middle daughter Claire in pink, and their youngest daughter London right there in the middle. They are a family who, I suppose, not unlike many others, but they are also a family who have achieved surprising success, it would seem, in life. Back in 2014, Lincoln, the son, was in the second grade, and he was given that piece of homework that I think all dads look forward to receiving one day. It was science fair time, and Lincoln had that freedom that you rarely get given when homework is set to kind of explore the boundaries of whatever took his interest. It's that chance that kids can have to explore their creativity. And the possibilities, they're almost endless. But Lincoln, he was a typical boy, and he knew exactly what he wanted to do. He wanted to know what was inside of sports balls. He wanted to know what's inside of baseballs and footballs and basketballs and all of those things. He wanted to know how those things that he loved so much really worked. Of course, when you're seven, actually opening up a baseball is perhaps easier said than done. So he turned to his dad and asked for help. As is so often the case with science fair projects, once the dad gets involved, things quickly take a turn. And have a tendency to escalate a little bit. Before they knew what was going on, they weren't just searching for photos of a sports ball on the internet or even cutting one open. They were videoing and documenting the whole process. They were making a documentary about what was inside of a sports ball. Using a handsaw and gathered around the dining room table, much, I'm sure, to the mum's chagrin, they began to cut each ball open, recording the whole process as they did. They chose five balls, a baseball, a golf ball, a tennis ball, a basketball, and a soccer ball, and contrasted the various different ways that these balls were constructed. They were surprised, for example, to discover that inside of a baseball is a whole ball of twine, wrapped around a small pink rubber ball about the size of the golf ball. When they opened up the golf ball, they were surprised to find that same small pink rubber ball. Apparently a baseball is just a golf ball wrapped in twine. Who knew? Wow. They, of course, had recorded the process and needed a way to share that video with the rest of the school. And so they uploaded it to a fledgling little startup platform, YouTube. At the time, they didn't think too much about it. They assumed it would just be an easy and convenient way to let their friends and family and the other people in the class see the work that they'd been doing, to go a little bit further than you can do on merely a poster board. They uploaded these videos. That was the thumbnail of the first one that they uploaded, and left it there. This was January 2014. However, as the dad, Dan, says, fast forward to December 2014, and out of nowhere, random people around the world began watching the videos of us cutting open these balls. This is what he told to a local news station. They started to ask in the comment section to cut open more items. By early June, they had 1,000 subscribers, a major milestone on the YouTube platform. people love to watch them opening up these everyday items and couldn't believe what they were finding inside. But that's not where things stopped. By the end of June, they had not only got 1,000 subscribers, they'd crossed 10,000. By August, they had 100,000 subscribers. Their videos had amassed over 7 million combined views. Over time, they began to break open not just sports balls, but other everyday items. Computers and phones and various pieces of their family Tesla. The seats and the engine and the tyres. One of their particularly popular videos was breaking open one of those Dyson bladeless fans. I'm not sure if you've seen them. To figure out just how this thing worked. They cut open video game cartridges and hundreds of other things beside. The format evolved over time. The production qualities improved. But the core of what made the channel popular stayed the same. It was about discovering what's inside. In fact, that's the name of the channel. Something about the format, it just resonated with people. Something about taking these everyday items, things that we touch and hold and use every day, and opening them up to find out how they really work, what's going on under the surface. It scratched that universal itch that people seem to have. Today they have over 7 million subscribers. Their videos have been watched more than 1.5 billion with a B times. Of course, that also includes things like brand integrations and sponsorship and all kinds of other things these days. But at its core, the channel remains the same. A dad and his son busting things open to discover what's inside. Being willing to make a mess along the way just to get to the truth of something. Why do I tell you all of this? Well, for one, it's just a fun channel. I would encourage you all go and watch it. They're a fun couple, a fun family. It's very family friendly. And at least for me, it scratches that itch. But there's more than that. I think it speaks to something far more universal than that. The world, our situation, so often things seem out of control and hard to understand. As humans, we desire to seek meaning, to understand, to know what makes things tick, and discover what's actually going on. Jesus himself, he addresses this very thing in the next section we're going to think about this morning. So let's read together, beginning in John chapter 2, starting at verse 13. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went to the went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, in the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip out of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." So the Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking about the temple of his body. When he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word of Jesus and the words that Jesus had spoken. Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. We are continuing to work through this Gospel of John. Last week we left Jesus having just turned water into wine at the wedding in Cana. Since then, there's a little transition passage that we skipped over, verse 12, that says, after this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and his disciples and stayed there for a few days. So Jesus, he's been in Capernaum. This kind of becomes his home base for the early parts of his ministry, but not long after he arrives in Capernaum. The time of Passover is coming, and it's actually time for him to travel up to Jerusalem. It wasn't obligatory for Jews to visit the temple in Jerusalem at Passover, but it was normal and would certainly be expected that those who could would. This is the first of three times John describes Jesus going to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. This seemed to be something that Jesus would always make the effort to do, no matter where he was or what other ministry he was doing. In addition to the celebrations and the meals and the feasts and the sacrifices that would be offered, it was also a time of worship. It was a time where the people would gather in Jerusalem to worship God, to remember him taking them out of Egypt at the time of the Exodus. It's a time where they remember and to celebrate and worship God for all that he's done. And so when Jesus goes to the temple and discovers the money changers and those selling animals for sacrifice, he sees that the temple has been defiled. And that breaks his heart. It's interesting, right? Because last week, if you were here with us, when we thought about the wedding at Cana, we thought about how Jesus went out of his way not to publicly reveal himself. We thought about how he actually kind of denies his mother's request to publicly reveal himself because he said, it's not yet my time. It's not yet time for me to be revealed for who I am. So it's strange that here, just a few days or weeks later, here he is standing in the temple doing this incredibly public thing. At the wedding in Cana, Jesus does the miracle, but remains hidden. But here, he chooses not to remain hidden. He takes a very public stand. It's interesting, right? What gives here? Why does his response so different, and what can we learn from this? Let's dive in together. I think the first thing that we need to draw out of this passage, the first key to remember here, is simply this. When Jesus arrives at the temple, he sees something incredibly holy that is being profaned. Jesus becomes incredibly aware of the fact that there is something very out of line here. Historically, at least at this time in history, the temple, it represents the dwelling place of God. The centre of the temple, it was a place known as the Holy of Holies, a place where only the high priest could enter, and even then only once a year, and only after undergoing all kinds of ritual cleansing and purification for themselves. This was a place where God's holiness was on full display, where his presence was manifest and tangible. We don't read this in scripture, but it is Jewish tradition, at least, that at this time in history, whenever the priests would go into that most holy of place, that they would tie a cord or a chain around their ankle. The reason for this was simple. This place was so holy. God's presence there was so awesome that it wasn't uncommon, perhaps, for them to be overcome in his presence, that they would pass out, or worse, perhaps had not got their own hearts right, had some sin in them that caused God to strike them dead. This chain then became a means by which the other priest could drag the priest out without having to enter into that place and risk the same fate. This was a place where they tangibly understood just how seriously God took his holiness. I don't think the people had lost sight of that truth. God is holy and worthy of awe and reverence. And yet at the same time, over time, various outer courts had been added to the temple, so more could enter and approach and participate. In one sense, this is a very good thing. The court of women, the court of Gentiles, all of these other outer courts, they allowed for more people to approach God's presence, to make their own sacrifices, to worship him, to be taught about his truth, to grow in the knowledge of the law. This is not a bad thing. And yet, it became defiled and defiling. People saw an opportunity to make money out of this, to exploit the people in their worship, to make it about something else other than true worship of God. In the Old Testament, offerings and sacrifices, they were a generous gift of those things that the people had grown and raised themselves. Grain offerings, food offerings, wine offerings, animal offerings. They were reflective of God's generosity to the people in providing for their needs. It was a way to give back something to God because of his generous provision. But by this point it had shifted somewhat. You couldn't bring your own offerings to the temple. You would have to buy them there in the courts. More than that, you couldn't buy them with the money you had and that you'd use in everyday life. You would first need to convert your denarius and your drachma and the other money that you carried around in your wallet into Tyrian shekels, the only money that was accepted in the temple. It was used both to pay the temple tax and also to pay for the animals and the grain and the wine and the oil and the other things that were sacrificed there.
They kind of overcharged.
They did indeed. What's interesting, I think sometimes, yeah, we imagine these Tyrian shekels as being like this special sanctified set apart currency used for God. You know, this kind of currency that the Jews themselves set aside for the use of God in the temple, that they didn't want their worship to be polluted or by the money of the time even. And perhaps that might have been a valid thing, but that isn't the case. Tyrian shekels, they were Roman currency. That name, Tyrian, it comes from the city of Tyre, which is a city that has all kinds of baggage in the Old Testament. It was the location of one of the Roman mints. Had been closed around 20 years prior to this. The money had no value in society. But a local mint in Jerusalem continued to produce these coins. It's interesting because these holy, sanctified, set-apart coins that you could only use in the temple at this point, they had the image of the Phoenician god Malkuth, known in or kind of linked in Roman mythology with the hero Heracles. They had this idolatrous image on them, and even still, that was what became the currency of God's temple. As has already been pointed out, they could also then charge a premium. These were not coins you could find anywhere else. You had to go into the temple and pay far, far above the odds at the money changers' temple. This thing that was holy and sanctified and set apart and good, it had been polluted and corrupted by all kinds of profane and idolatrous things. A love of money. The temple at the time, it was a place on earth where God's presence dwelled. And yet, everything that surrounded it was anything but clean. In a New Testament context, then, as believers, we're told that God himself is enthroned upon our hearts. We become the temple of God. In us, there is this incredibly holy thing. And yet, how often do we do the same thing? Do we surround it by all kinds of profane things that defile? Of course, there are sinful things that defile us. That is well known, I think, to any of us. We know our own hearts. We know all of the sinful things we do.
What's an example of something? Like, I could do that would defile myself, but would be an
example? I mean, there is all kinds of sinful things. There's lists all throughout the New Testament, you know, the love of money, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life, all of those kind of things that defile. The cares of life, all of those things, when we give into that temptation to sin.
That
absolutely.
We're not supposed to be acting like them.
But what's feeding?
I mean, yeah, maybe. Yeah, like the those things that we do that we know we ought not to do, they are sin. But it's more than that. I think often we get hung up on the idea of sin as a list of do's and don'ts. I much prefer Tim Keller's definition of sin. He says that all sin at its heart is idolatry. And idolatry happens whenever we take even good things and make them the ultimate thing. Here's the thing, sacrifices, the temple tax, they were good things. They were a means by which people met with God. At that time, they were something that was holy and righteous, were sanctified. And yet, even in those things, they found a way to take this good thing and profane it by making it something else.
Kind of the devil's job.
That is absolutely it, right? Even things that are good can so easily become polluted and corrupted when they take God's proper place on the throne of our heart. When we make it about what we do rather than why we do it and the one who we serve. When we make it about the motions and the action and going through these things rather than understanding the God who we serve. When we make it about the performance and the show rather than the reverence and the awe. In some ways, we defile the temple of our hearts. When we worship the things and give them priority over the one who gave us those things, that too is every bit as defiling, as the worst of the worst sins. When we don't. Absolutely.
They wouldn't identify him as my father.
Right.
And so they would take the glory to themselves. Well, we killed all them giants, and
we
did this, and we did that.
That's...
But how we bless God is identifying how he blessed us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's the first takeaway, I guess. All kinds of things, good and bad, can easily defile and profane the holy place that God has set himself upon in our heart when we allow other things to take the priority there. And so when Jesus sees his temple profaned, zeal for the house consumes him. He has no choice but to act. Jesus wasn't willing to reveal himself at the wedding because he didn't need to. He could accomplish his purposes without needing to make a big show of it. But he did here because holiness demanded it. Some things, they can be delayed, they can be put off, they can be done quietly. Some things can be resolved over time without needing to make the big public show. But some things, they demand a whip. Some things are so serious that they simply can't be ignored, that they must be confronted for what they are. Pastor Randy Davis is the pastor at First Baptist Church in Durham, North Carolina. He says this: zeal for the house. What is zeal? It's fire, and it literally devoured him. Zeal for your house has eaten him up. It's like a fire that burns in Jesus' heart for God's holiness and his temple to be pure and holy. Zeal is burning in his heart. Jesus' zeal here is for true worship. God desires his people to have his passion and his purity, zealous for God and pure from idols. Jesus sent his son into the world. He tells the Samaritan woman, God is seeking those who will worship him in spirit and truth, for these are the kind that the Father seeks. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. When Jesus sees the temple being defiled, when he sees stumbling blocks in the way of freedom, he cannot help but act. Jesus wasn't concerned merely with the sanctity of the temple as a building. Within a few short decades, that building, it would be torn to its very foundations. In fact, Jesus even alludes to it here. Jesus is far less concerned about the building, about the place, than he is about what it represents. He's zealous here because he knows that these things are standing in the way of true worship. At this point, this is the only way to be right before God. Jesus has not yet gone to the cross. He hasn't yet made that once and for all final sacrifice for sin. At this point, the way that you would worship God in spirit and truth is through this observance of those prophetic symbolic sacrifices. And man was put in a stumbling block in the way of that. If the temple back then, it was that building, that place surrounded by the Holy of Holies, and Jesus was zealous for that, for its purity, for its sanctity, because it prevented people from reaching God, imagine then just how much more zealous he is for the temple that is our hearts. Imagine how much more passionate he is to drive out all that stands in the way of the freedom and holiness, the worship that he is due. Jesus came to set the captive free, and he took that so seriously he went and he bled and died in our place for it. Imagine then how much more zealous he is for seeing our temples cleansed and purified. Imagine how much more it breaks his heart when he sees all of those ways that we don't walk in that. Anything that becomes a stumbling block for God's people, anything that stands in the way of true worship, God wants to remove it. God desires that we will know freedom. It's prophetic. When Jesus drives out these things from the temple, he is making a symbolic, declarative, prophetic act of what he came here to do. People don't often like spoilers when we read books or when we watch movies. We don't like to know what happens at the end. When the Harry Potter books came out, and I'm not recommending them to you, but they were certainly very popular. When they came out, it was quite common for radio DJs in the UK to say that they'd got advanced copies and to tell people what was going on at the end. Of course, they didn't. It was all a joke. But people got up in arms and upset when these kind of things happened because they don't want the ending to be spoiled. But Jesus is not afraid to spoil the ending here. He's not afraid to tell people what this is really all about. Even in this moment, he tells them. This is about the cross. this is about the ending. The temple that'll be destroyed and brought back in 3 days, that is me. It's my body. He makes a whip and uses it to remove all that defiles the temple. And 3 and a bit years later, another whip will tear flesh from his body as he goes to the cross. Here, he symbolically drives out that which has polluted the physical temple as a symbol of what he came to do with the sin that pollutes our hearts. When Jesus goes to the cross, he does so as that once and for all final perfect sacrifice to drive out the sin that has defiled once and for all. He tells them outright, this is what he came to do. And when the disciples 3 years later see him go to the cross raised from the dead, this is the moment, we're told here, that they remember. When Jesus is resurrected, a new temple comes into being, one that exists in the hearts of everyone who will believe in him. That curtain in the temple, the physical temple, is torn in two, top to bottom. His spirit is set free to rule and to reign in the hearts of all. He offers that final better sacrifice and sits enthroned on our hearts. This is what he came to do. But then we end, perhaps as we begin, with this final thought, this strange passage that we read in verse 23 and 24. Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his own part, did not entrust himself to them, because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about him, for he himself knew what was in man. We started by thinking about that universal itch that we all have to understand what's really going on below the surface, to make sense of things that seem not to make sense to us. And Jesus, he tells us that he, and perhaps he alone, truly understands what's going on here. He, above all others, knows what is in the heart of man. He alone understands our greatest needs and how things work on the deepest levels. Here's a sad reality about this incident. We read this at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, about him going into the temple, driving out the money lenders, overturning the tables, sending out those who have brought in these profane and unclean sacrifices, tipping out over the money. And we also read it in the Synoptic Gospels, but they don't place it here at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. They place it at the end, right before he's about to go to the cross. Some theologians try to suggest that perhaps this is one incident that's just, they've shifted the timeline around a little bit. I don't think that's the case. I actually think Jesus did this twice, once at the beginning and again at the end of his ministry. Here's the sad truth. Jesus came to make this prophetic declaration about what he came to do, and yet for so many, nothing changed. Writing upon this particular strange bit that we get at the end, Ligonier Ministries, the ministry of R.C. Sproul, they put this in one of their devotionals. The Greek word for entrust is the same word which is translated as believed in verse 23. In other words, the people believed in Jesus, but he did not believe in them. John means that the people in Jerusalem who believed did not, for the most part, have true saving faith. They saw great signs, and on account of that, they had some understanding of who Jesus was, but they did not actually receive and rest upon him for salvation. It was a primarily signs-based faith, and not a primarily gospel-based faith. John Calvin comments that their faith depended solely on miracles and had no root in the gospel, and therefore could not be steady or permanent. Miracles do indeed assist the children of God in arriving at the truth, but it does not amount to actual believing when they admire the power of God so as merely to believe that it is true, but not to subject themselves wholly to it. There is a difference between seeing the power of God and accepting that it's happened, and then placing your eternal hope and trust in the God who demonstrated the power. The question for Jesus is not about whether or not they've had an encounter with him that leaves them even in awe of who he is, whether they see miracles and are impressed. Though those things can, of course, create in the heart of man true worship. The question for him is, upon seeing those things, are they truly willing to allow him to come in and take control of the temple? Or will they quickly return to those idolatrous things that have always taken God's place in their hearts? There's a universal human desire to know what's inside. There's a universal desire to know how things work. To understand what's going on under the surface, to discover the truth of the matter, sometimes it requires busting stuff open, exposing stuff for what it really is. Here, Jesus tells us what's inside. He points out all of the things that have defiled, that have separated, that have stood in the way of true worship. And he loves his people enough to do everything it takes to drive those things out, to remove those stumbling blocks from our lives, from our hearts, from our minds. As we surrender to him, as we allow him to act in our own lives, he is ready and willing to remove each of those stumbling blocks from us. He stands ready. He is driven by zeal to make things right. That's what he did on the cross, and that's what he continues to do to this very day. We're going to share communion. And communion, it is a lot of things. It's a reminder of what Christ sacrificed. It's a way of proclaiming and sharing the gospel. It is all of those things. But when we read some of the verses about communion, we're also given an important reminder. We are encouraged to examine our hearts. We're encouraged to take that time to ensure that we are right before him. In an ultimate sense, we know that we are all right before God if we have indeed accepted his sacrifice. In an ultimate sense, we stand before God in a righteousness that is not our own. And yet in communion, we remember that Jesus did not just come to stamp a ticket to heaven so that when we die, we'll have our express pass directly into his presence. But that through his ministry of reconciliation, he came that we could live life, and life to the fullest, even here and now, that we can truly be free from those things that have defiled us. So that's what we're going to do. We're just going to take a few moments now to examine our hearts, to bring before God anything that has been standing in the way of who he would have us be and what he would want to do in our hearts and in our minds and in our lives. We'll take the opportunity just to hand those things off to him and to trust that through his work on the cross, he has already dealt with them. And then together we'll share and we'll celebrate and we'll remember that he has indeed done this very thing. So just quietly in our own hearts and minds now, let's just take a few moments to lay at the foot of the cross anything that we've been struggling with, that's been standing in our way, anything that even has taken God's proper place.